Hello and welcome to another episode of the Wounded Blue Hour here on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton, 34-year law enforcement veteran, author of a number of books, including the soon-to-be-released Rescuing 911, The Fight for America's Safety, and the founder of the Wounded Blue, the National Assistance and Support Organization for Injured and Disabled Law Enforcement Officers. On this show, we talk about all things related to the health, both physical health, emotional well-being of the America's law enforcement community, every aspect of their health, including spiritual. So we have so much to talk about. I have a phenomenal guest waiting for us in the waiting room. But as you know, if you listen to the show or watch this show, you know that we always start off with eulogizing the officers who have lost their lives in the line of duty since the previous week and the previous show. And I'm literally traumatized by what has happened in the last couple of weeks with the number of officers who've been killed in the line of duty, not to mention those who have been shot in the line of duty. It's astounding. We're going to talk about that. But first of all, I want to eulogize, I want to memorialize those officers who have died in the line of duty in just the last several weeks, including four in one incident. It's astounding. So, first, I'm going to read is Police Officer Kyle Hicks, Corpus Christi Police Department, Texas. Police Officer Kyle Hicks succumbed to gunshot wounds sustained 4 days earlier while responding to a domestic dispute in the 4900 block of Burnham Drive. He and another officer located the apartment at 12:30 a.m., could hear a man and woman arguing inside. A male subject came to the door, and a struggle ensued during which Officer Hicks was shot. The other officer was able to return fire and killed the suspect. Officer Hicks was transported to a local hospital where he succumbed to his wounds and his organs were donated. He served with the Corpus Christi PD for 2 years, survived by a wife and four children. Police Officer Kyle Hicks, Corpus Christi Police, Texas. End of watch Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. Investigator John Hampton Kodu, the third, Harris County Sheriff's Office, Texas. Investigator John Kodu was struck and killed while helping at the scene of a vehicle crash in Houston. 9:30 a.m., the investigator responded to a minor collision near Cumberland Ridge Drive. He parked on the center median with his lights activated. A truck traveling north swerved to avoid hitting the patrol vehicle and struck Investigator Kodu in the median. He was transported to Herman Medical Center, where he succumbed to his injuries. He served with the United States Army and was a Harris County Sheriff's deputy for 20 years, survived by his wife and mother. Investigator John Hampton Kodu III, Harris County Sheriff's Office, Texas. End of watch Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. Sergeant Ian Taylor, Bellarica Police Department in Massachusetts. Sergeant Ian Taylor was struck and killed by a piece of construction equipment while working an assignment at the intersection of Boston Road and Pollard Street at 2 p.m. He was assisting a tractor trailer pass through the construction zone when he was struck by an excavator that was backing up. He was transported to the hospital where he succumbed to his injuries. He had served with the Bellarica Police Department for 13 years, survived by his wife and three children. Sergeant Ian Taylor, Bellarica Police Department, Massachusetts, end of watch Friday, April 26, 2024. Police Officer Russell Croxton, DuBois Police Department in Louisiana. Police Officer Russell Croxton was struck and killed by a tractor trailer while conducting a traffic stop at 1 p.m. The vehicle he was pulling over stopped in the right travel lane of the four-lane highway. As Officer Croxton spoke with the driver, a tractor trailer failed to move over, struck the back of his patrol truck before striking him and the other vehicle. Officer Croxton was transported to the hospital where he succumbed to his injuries. Officer Croxton's father, Sergeant Raymond Croxton, was killed in the line of duty May 23, 1978. Police Officer Russell Croxton, Dubosc Police Department, Louisiana. End of watch Saturday, April 27th, 2024. Police Officer Jordan Wingate, Oakland Police Department, California. Police Officer Jordan Wingate succumbed to injuries sustained on August 13th, 2018, while responding to a suspicious person call at the Port of Oakland. He was driving in the 1900 block at 2:50 a.m. when a vehicle pulled into his path. Officer Wingate's patrol SUV struck the vehicle and then struck a parked tractor trailer. Rescue personnel extricated him from the vehicle, transported him to a nearby hospital. He medically retired in 2020 and remained under medical care until his succumbed to his injuries April 20th. He had served the Oakland PD for 3 years. Police Officer Jordan Wingate, Oakland Police Department. End of watch Saturday, April 20th, 24. Now, yesterday, four law enforcement officers gave their lives in the line of duty while serving a warrant and serving on a federal fugitive task force. United States Marshal Thomas Weeks, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Officer Joshua Iyer, the North Carolina Adult Corrections Officers Sam Polish and Alden Elliott, all were killed in the same incident. All of these officers, whose names I just read, gave their lives in the line of duty serving the communities, and may they rest in peace. My guest today, Don Bostic. Don, I'm going to read a little bit of his pedigree, because if I read all of it, we're going to be here the rest of the night. So Don is a retired FBI agent, instructor at the FBI National Academy, who specializes in law enforcement wellness matters. Don taught undergraduate and graduate level courses entitled Wellness and Vitality in Law Enforcement and Leading At-Risk Employees. He spoken to law enforcement officers across the nation, in addition to officer wellness, other topics as well, from undercover work to international terrorism. He served both as a law enforcement officer and in the FBI. And like I said, his pedigree is incredible. I am happy to have him on the show. Don, thank you so much for joining me here on the Wounded Blue Hour. I appreciate you taking the time.
Randy, thank you very much for having me as a guest on your program today. I look forward to our conversation, but like you, I am deeply moved by the tragedies of this past week. It's unspeakable to lose so many officers in such a short period of time. And regardless of whether it was via an accident or adversarial action, they are all tragic nonetheless.
Absolutely, 100%. You know, before we get into the meat of what we're going to be talking about today, I'd like the audience to get to know you a little bit. You had a storied career in law enforcement. You traveled the road less traveled, going from a police officer to the FBI. If you would, talk about, you know, where you grew up and what was it that led you to decide that law enforcement was going to be your career and your life?
What a great question, and thank you for that intro. So, like many of those of us who have worn blue or brown uniforms in our lives, that quest to serve others starts at a very young age. So I was born in the mountains of West Virginia, but raised in the outskirts of Washington, D.C. And growing up, you know, obviously, like many of my brothers and sisters in law enforcement, had some struggles early on. And throughout those struggles, it seems like we develop a warrior or a guardian mentality as a part of our survival. And that really stuck with me. And then after going to college and looking for a career path, those skill sets that we learn early on in life kind of come to bear. So it was a natural progression for me to want to be a police officer. So I joined the ranks of the Danville Police Department in about 1986, which seems like a lifetime ago. But it was actually, it was the joy of my life, being a street officer, then a detective, a lieutenant, overseeing special investigations. That's where the rubber meets the road, and has absolutely been my the highlight of my life's work. But after about 12 years or so serving at the local level, I was on several federal task forces, and I decided to give that a try. So I applied for the FBI and was accepted, and in 1998 graduated from the academy and was sent to Lafayette, Louisiana, of all places. And having never been to Louisiana and not knowing much about that culture, I was probably less than enthused would be the best way to describe it, of being assigned to Louisiana. So I endeavored to go down and spend a couple of years and then move on through the ranks. But having experienced the life in Cajun country, I can tell you that it is one of the best kept secrets in America. And I stayed there for about 20 years. In fact, my adult children now refer to themselves as Cajuns, and they both have grown up and married Louisiana natives. And, you know, I joke with people that the folks in Louisiana eat the bait that the rest of us fish with throughout the country. But I tell you, until you've actually tried that culture and that food, you don't know what you're missing. But towards the end of my career, my father passed away, and my family, again, being from the Northern Virginia area, right outside of D.C., I decided to relocate so that I could be a help to my mother. And I took a position at the FBI Academy at Quantico, where I taught at the National Academy. And most of your listeners will be very familiar with the National Academy. It's a 10-week resident course for police executives from around the world. And they come there to study various executive and leadership courses. I was assigned to teach wellness, which many people don't view as a leadership course, but I tell you, it is one of the most important leadership courses, because until you are in a good headspace, you are going to be less than effective as a leader. So I served there for about 4 years, and after retiring completely, I've gone on to consult for several companies, to include Axon and Performance Protocol, and started my own law enforcement training company called My Brother's Keeper. And I can think of no better name for law enforcement training than My Brother's Keeper, because we are, in fact, our brothers and sisters keepers. So that's what brings me to you today, having met at a recent conference. And I know we share a lot of similar passions and a similar background. So thank you again for having me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And yeah, for the audience, I want you to know that I was at the Axon conference just a week ago, where I met Don and I watched him speak. And what I found so impressive about Don is, well, first of all, his resume is stellar. I mean, to leave a police department as a lieutenant, to then enter the academy and start your career all over again in the FBI, there's very, very few people who are so driven that they would do that to begin with. And secondly, you know, watching Don engage in what he talks about involving law officer wellness with the other people who were with him on the panel and those he interacted with, I could sense his passion. He's clearly a phenomenal communicator, and so he's a perfect guest for this show, where everything we talk about is about the law enforcement community and their you know, every aspect of their health. So, Don, I want to circle back just a little bit in your past. I similarly left my police job in Princeton, New Jersey, which was a smaller agency, probably about the same size as your ex-agency. After 10 years, I mean, you were halfway to retirement when you made the decision to leave. That's a big deal. What was it that called to you that said, I want to completely reinvent myself and reinvent where I live, every aspect of your life, uproot it to become an FBI agent?
Yeah, it was an interesting set of circumstances that unfolded. I had made an application to the FBI National Academy to attend as a student and was accepted. And about the same time I got the acceptance letter to attend the National Academy, I got the acceptance letter for my application as a special agent. I had been exposed to the federal law enforcement side of the house, having been on several different task forces with the DEA, the FBI, and the U.S. Marshals. And it was through that exposure that I saw the potential of what I could experience and the impact I possibly could have at a national level. And so it was quite a change, and it was a very challenging prospect to go from an established local law enforcement career to start over brand new. I was one of the oldest people in my class at the age of 34.
I feel your pain.
Yeah, so it's not so easy going through at the age of 34. Of course, you know, you have to be less than 37 to be hired as an FBI agent because it's a mandatory retirement at the age of 57. But at 34, to be put in a class with some folks from their mid-20s and have to compete with them both in the physical training and in the classroom, it was quite the experience. But I was motivated by wanting to experience new things. I had never been in the military, and I endeavored to see the world and just kind of get outside of my bubble.
And wound up in Louisiana.
Yes, that was kind
you,
of being.
You saw the world. You saw the world.
That was kind of being in an international location. But while there, I had the opportunity to do several temporary duty assignments in Iraq, Yemen, and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, as well as do some teaching at the International Law Enforcement Academy in Budapest, Hungary. So I did, in fact, get to accomplish that goal of seeing some other places.
And the and many of the garden spots of the world.
Yes, places that I don't intend to ever go back to by choice.
Well, let's... So, you know, you're clearly an individual who is who likes challenges, and as evidenced by, you know, your career change as well as, you know, your decisions to move forward into the a space that was you know, related but still much more challenging. Before we get into, you know, where you are now as far as your, you know, your passion for helping other law enforcement personnel. Let's talk about yesterday. I mean, because we are just reeling from this loss. For those of you who are tuning in and may not have heard about what took place, there was a federal task force, United States Marshals Fugitive Task Force, and we'll explain what that means in just a second. They went to survey an arrest warrant on an individual wanted as an ex-felon in possession of a firearm in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina. Now, we don't have all the facts yet, but what I've been told is that they had the suspect under surveillance. They went to take him down in the front yard of a residence, and when they announced themselves, the individual produced a weapon, opened fire on the officers. The officers returned fire and killed the suspect. But then, what so tragically, no one expected, was that there were two people in the residence, and they are just being identified as a 17-year-old male and a female. And someone, one of those two individuals, opened fire in an ambush from the house and killed the those three members of the task force, of the fugitive task force, as well as Charlotte Mecklenburg police officers who were responding to the scene on a shots fired, officers need help call. And four more officers were shot during that. The original suspect was deceased, and the SWAT unit surrounded the house, and they eventually negotiated the female and the 17-year-old out of the house. But this was one of the deadliest days in recent law enforcement history, Don. The last time I remember multiple officers being injured and shot and killed was Dallas during the insane, you know, Black Lives Matter protests. And then, you know, before that, there were four officers that were ambushed in a Starbucks up in Seattle, who were literally having coffee, and an individual just walked up to him and opened fire. But this was the reverberations of this incident yesterday are just beginning to be felt within both the public and also in the realm of law enforcement. And this is where I want to address where you are now in your career with helping officers deal with the emotional traumas of being cops, as I do in my role as the founder of the Wounded Blue. This is going to have an effect on an immeasurable number of people, police officers and the families of those police officers. Let's talk about this and about how the ripple effect is going to now branch out within the law enforcement community, beginning in Charlotte and then oozing out, if you will, into, you know, it's affected me. I don't know any of these officers. It's affected you. You don't know any of these officers, and police officers around this country, even though they don't know them, are feeling the effects. Let's talk about how now this is going to, how this is going to affect the emotional well-being of cops all over this country. Let's start with what's going to happen with the officers, you know, that were on the task force that were killed, and then those that were injured.
Yeah. So we obviously live in an increasingly dangerous world, as evidenced not only by what's happened yesterday, but even today with, you know, we've got protests all over the country. It seems like every time we turn on the news, there's just more and more tragedy. But there's no more unspeakable tragedy than those men and women who have given their lives in service of their communities to be needlessly slain. It's hard to put into words. And so what happened yesterday will have an astounding impact for not only the days to come, but weeks, months, and perhaps years for some. We understand that trauma, being involved in an officer-involved shooting or a death or any of those tragedies, those are kind of the capital T traumas that really stand out as life-impacting. But what we often overlook are those traumas that perhaps don't affect us immediately and personally. As you said a moment ago, you or I, neither one knew any of these officers. But nevertheless, there's something known as vicarious trauma. And that is when you have a connection with another person who experiences a capital T trauma, some of those traumatic effects can impact you, even though you were not there and didn't see or experience any of those events. Many of the experiences you and I and other listeners here have had over the years that were impactful and very dangerous in the moment, and we feel like we've unpacked those things and we've left them behind us, we really haven't. They still are with us. And when another experience like this event of yesterday occurs, it can have the impact of opening up old wounds, of causing us to reflect and think back and again, experience some of our own traumas, even though we're experiencing this one particularly vicariously.
Okay, we have to take a quick break and then come back and let's jump right back into this. But we have to take a quick break right now.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill, it's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company launched the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. The Wellness Company's chief medical board designed every supplement and medical protocol with your health in mind. From groundbreaking supplements like the Spike Support Formula to unique care like Freedom from Big Pharma. Join a healthcare system that puts your health and well-being above the interest of Big Pharma's bottom line. It's the way healthcare should be, with a company that shares your values. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutLoud.shop. That's AmericaOutLoud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutLoud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Hi, this is Randy Sutton from The Wounded Blue. Every day, law enforcement officers put their lives on the line to protect our communities. Unfortunately, many of these brave men and women suffer injuries, both physical and emotional, in the line of duty. That's where The Wounded Blue comes in. The Wounded Blue is on a mission to improve the lives of injured and disabled law enforcement officers. Through our dedicated peer advocate support program and extensive community outreach efforts, we are working tirelessly to destigmatize mental health within the law enforcement community. We believe that those who serve and protect us should never be forgotten and never feel alone. That's why we're reaching out to you, our community, for support. Your donations can make a real difference in the lives of these officers and their families. With your help, we can provide vital resources, support services, and advocacy for those who have sacrificed so much for our safety. Together, we can ensure that our injured and disabled law enforcement officers receive the care and respect they deserve. Join us in honoring their service and supporting their journey to healing. Donate to the Wounded Blue today and make a meaningful impact in the lives of those who protect and serve. Thank you for your generosity and your support. This is Randy Sutton. Hi, this is Randy Sutton, founder of the Wounded Blue. If you are a law enforcement officer now or have been, I want you to listen to this. The 4th Annual National Law Enforcement Survival Summit will be hosted in Las Vegas, September 26th through the 29th at the fabulous Ahern Hotel. This is an incredible conference, every aspect of surviving a law enforcement career. And we have some incredible speakers, including Travis Howes, who, if you've never seen him speak, you're in for a treat. And all of the speakers are dedicated to improving the lives of injured and disabled officers, whether those injuries are physical or emotional and psychological. But this is designed for current officers and those who have served. Go to thewoundedblue.org and register now. It's only $325. It will change your life. I want to tell you about a product. It's a service that I believe that every law enforcement officer needs to know about. It's called OfficerPrivacy.com. OfficerPrivacy.com is a service that is being provided by a retired law enforcement professional who discovered that there is so much information about us on the internet, including the personal information that we don't want there, such as where we live. I don't want people knowing where I live if I can possibly help it. And there's a bunch of other private information that you don't want people to know either. Well, I didn't even know that so many of these searchable sites existed until Officer Privacy, Pete James, who is the creator of this, showed me. And I tell you, it sent a little chill down my spine. But what he did, he created this service for a very nominal fee. He has law enforcement professionals. Everybody he hires has been a police officer or is a police officer. They go into the internet and they actually scrub information off of the internet and these search sites that can lead to your safety issues. To me, this is a no-brainer. Easy stuff. Go to officerprivacy.com. Check them out. Talk to the folks over there. It's not expensive. And for me, it's a no-brainer. Go to officerprivacy.com and tell them Randy sent you. Don, come on back in. Let's continue where we were. So we were talking about vicarious trauma. And that's something that, many officers themselves are unaware that they can be affected by things that maybe they didn't have any idea that they would be affected by. So let's talk more about that.
Yeah, so there are a couple of different aspects of trauma that we often overlook. We just mentioned the vicarious trauma when someone we care about experiences a major life-threatening event. That can have an impact on us. But there's also something known as cumulative trauma. And we often look at these traumatic events as the lowercase t of trauma. And these are I like to say it's like being pecked to death by a chicken. It's these day in and day out episodes of, every time we stop a car, that has the potential of being life altering for us or life endangering. So all of these small episodes that we often don't really give a second thought to build up in our psyche. And over time, that accumulation of these small T traumas these small threats have a way of manifesting themselves when a major trauma comes out. So it's not just the event of yesterday that traumatizes us. It is the accumulation of years and years of service and years of danger that we have often taken for granted.
While we're talking about that, I know exactly what you mean. I look at it as the water dripping into the bucket. You know, you seem fine and you're fine and you're fine, and then suddenly it may be an innocuous incident that is that final drip into the bucket where suddenly it begins to overflow. Now, what's interesting in the world of the understanding of post-traumatic stress injury is that even though it's been around since, way before, we were even born, it's just now being processed within the law enforcement community as a legitimate issue. You know, for years, we were the victims of the suck 'em up buttercup, syndrome. And it's only recently in the last, 10 or 15 years maybe, where it's actually being accepted that post-traumatic stress can be a debilitating disease, that's not the wrong word, it's not a disease, but can be a life-altering issue. But many agencies never recognize the word cumulative. If you couldn't ascertain that your trauma emanated from one particular incident, they just said, no, that can't be. Tell us about how the world has changed in law enforcement to the acceptance that post-traumatic stress is legitimate, and how in reality we're just really at the infancy of dealing with this situation that is literally taking lives of cops.
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm impressed with your framing of post-traumatic stress, as you called it, PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury, rather than disorder. After all, if you're talking to your friends or other officers and we start talking about PTSD, who wants to admit to having a disorder? That's as if you're being labeled and put in the box of broken toys just because of that acronym. So I think it is much more appropriate for us to talk about it in terms of a post-traumatic stress injury. After all, if one of your friends broke his leg at work, would you have any reservation whatsoever in telling that officer to go to an orthopedist, get his leg looked at, get in the cast, take 6 weeks off, and come back and get in the fight 6 weeks from now when you're healthy? It should be no different when we look at psychological injury because of trauma, whether it be cumulative, vicarious, or the big T traumas of officer shootings. So part of that assimilation into normalcy, this PTSI, is the reduction of stigma and a culture change. And I got to tell you, we've come a long way, obviously, even with a program such as yours that addresses these types of issues on a regular basis. We have a long way to go. Many officers that I talk to or agency leaders will say, I ask about what is your culture like at your department regarding wellness? And, oh, we have a good wellness culture. We have peer counseling and we have, physical fitness. We have all these programs. And I say, yeah, but that's not culture. Having wellness programs does not equal having a wellness culture. Are your officers able to talk openly about issues that arise? How vulnerable do you as an agency leader present? And I'm not talking about vulnerability in the aspect of that you should go into roll call and start crying because of everything you've experienced. But I'm talking about sitting down with officers and having a very candid discussion that we are not robots. Just because we put on a blue or brown uniform doesn't mean that we are invincible. We have to be proactive. So a lot of what I have dedicated myself to over the last 6 or 7 years in particular is what I call left of bang. And that is preparing ourselves to experience the inevitable traumas that this career is going to bring to us. So investing in ourselves, investing in our fellow brothers and sisters in a way that that makes these discussions more normal, even going to the point of talking about suicide. I mean, gosh, that's not the most enjoyable dinner time conversation, but we should not be shying away from these conversations because conversations are the beginnings of healing.
You know, the suicide topic is one that is reverberating throughout the law enforcement community. This is something that's been shoved under the bricks for a long, long time. You know, I spent more than 30 years as a cop. I experienced a number of law enforcement suicides, people that I knew, people that I worked with, people that I buried as a member of the honor guard. And, you know, one thing I found is that there's always this level of why. You know, we it's so difficult for us to get our minds around. You know, one day we're talking with our one of our coworkers, and everything seems great. And the next day we come to work and we found out that he killed himself. And we don't understand how we could have missed any of the signs. And yet, when in retrospect, sometimes they're very glaring, some of these signs. Let's talk about that, and let's talk about as a cop, when you see someone that is evidencing issues that you recognize as being abnormal, what are the steps to take?
Oh, wow. Great question. And man, I wish this show was about 3 hours long.
So do I.
So part of what I do is deliver a course of instruction for a company called Living Works. And they are suicide experts. And while their program is not specifically tailored to law enforcement, it is very, very applicable. And so I'll tell you that I don't know if you enjoy playing poker. Many of your listeners will, and I'm sure that they understand what a tell is. So when you're holding certain cards in your hand, you want to bluff those around you by thinking you either have a good hand or a worse hand so that you can affect the betting of the other players. Those are called tells, and they are simple things like the way you hold your face or your expressions or maybe your tone of voice. Those are clues as to what you're really holding in your hand. Unfortunately, the world of suicide is very similar to that, and that is that many of us walk around holding a certain hand of cards that have been dealt us, and we want to hide that. But we often give tells to other people if they are alert and they are trained and aware. They can notice these tells. Simple things such as a change in your appearance, a change in the way you take care of yourself, being unusually reckless in your behavior, making such comments as, you know, gosh, my family would be better off if I wasn't around, giving some of your possessions away, being very sad for a period of time, and then all of the sudden seemingly happy. So these are all tells that, hey, something is going on behind the scenes. And so this one particular course that Living Works offers is called Safe Talk. And that's a course that I deliver, and I'm happy to talk with any of your listeners who might be interested in this. It's about a 3.5-hour course that tells folks how to be on the lookout for these tells, and then how to have a direct and pertinent, caring conversation with that person. We often shy away from that conversation because we don't know what to say, or we feel uncomfortable or unprepared. Some of us believe the myth that, gosh, if I ask someone if they are contemplating suicide, I'm going to plant that idea in their head. And that's absolutely a myth. So we teach folks how to recognize these signs and then have a conversation with this person find out exactly what they're thinking and feeling, and then how to connect them with appropriately trained people that can help change the direction and course of their life.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned really struck home with me when it comes down to tells, and that was seeing someone, one of your coworkers that, you know, may have appeared to be sad for a duration of time, a reflective, not their usual normal self, if you will. And then suddenly they become effusive, and it seems like, oh, wow, the old Randy is back, you know? But what that really means is that they've come to terms with making a decision that will end their life. And that is why that, making that decision has now unburdened them, if you will. And how many times do we, you know, does that happen where it winds up in tragedy?
Yes. And so a couple of things that I think is important to include in this conversation, and that is, we often think of someone who is suicidal as being broken or less than, but we should really be humble in the way we approach that, because the only difference between someone who is suicidal and someone who is not suicidal is a thought. And how quickly can a thought come into your mind? And that's perfectly normal. But when you start to ruminate on those thoughts and you start to spend an inordinate amount of time contemplating and really planning, that's when you're really in some deep water and you need some help. The second thing that we need to understand is that suicide does have a contagious aspect to it. So you will often find that in an organization or a family or a social group where a suicide occurs, that there may be a second or third suicide that ensues very quickly. And so we need to be aware of that, and especially on the lookout when our brothers and sisters do succumb to a suicidal thought and take their life. We need to be paying very close attention to their coworkers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to go back to the events of yesterday, the tragedy of the loss of four lives and the severe injuries of four more. Let's talk about the responding officers who came to that scene. You know, they may not have been involved in the firefight, but they saw the bodies of their friends. They may have even, you know, attempted to staunch the blood flow of one of the victims. But there's going to be a lot of police officers that responded to that scene. What should the police department be doing proactively to address the possibilities of the ramifications of this trauma?
So, first of all, the departments need to be normalizing the conversation so that we don't wait until that there is an event like yesterday to all of a sudden plan a critical incident debrief. Part of the critical incident debrief process is normalizing the conversation and letting folks understand that it is perfectly normal to have abnormal reactions to abnormal events. And that sounds a little convoluted, but when you are exposed to things like these officers were exposed to yesterday in the death of their friend and coworkers, it's going to be abnormal to them to experience things like nightmares, lack of appetite, increase in alcohol consumption, being short with their wives and their children, maybe withdrawing, maybe acting out in some other way. We need to understand that those are perfectly normal reactions to these abnormal events. It's when these reactions last for a period of time and they don't go away. That's the issue that the departments need to be on the lookout so that they can take some intervention measures and get some help. One of the most effective programs and tools that's out there for officers who have experienced trauma like those experienced yesterday is something called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It is a scientifically proven treatment that is recognized by the VA, the Department of Defense, the Department of Justice, and it is a relatively inexpensive, non-intrusive, easy way to address a traumatic experience in a way that gets you back to a normalized way of thinking.
Yeah, EMDR, of course, is a modality generally done by a practitioner, a psychologist, or, you know, Joe Blow down the street isn't doing EMDR, you know, although you could probably train, you know, anybody to do anything, but it is a modality, and I have had EMDR. I know its effectiveness, and I have seen many, many officers who have experienced trauma when they are exposed to EMDR, it literally can be life-changing for them. So this is one of the modalities that was never known before. You know, we didn't know how to deal with post-traumatic stress injury for years. I mean, they did shock therapy. They did everything, usually drugs involved, to mask it, but not to deal with it. So now we've seen some significant increases in the ability to treat, this issue. So EMDR is one of them. There's also stellate ganglion block, which is another, it's a little more intrusive because it involves a very slight surgical procedure. But these were never heard of before. So I really want to reiterate here, and I want to pound out, is that if you are suffering, if you don't have to suffer. First of all, you don't have to suffer by yourself. There are people like my organization that care. There's people, you know, like Don, you know, has done I don't know how many peer supports yourself where you've helped people get into treatment. There are people that care. And there are avenues to treatment that are unobtrusive, that are not they're not based upon putting you into an institution or things like that. There's so much available now, and that's one of the things that is a vast improvement, if you will. So let me ask you this: you're deeply involved in helping. You know, you're a retired guy. You could be fishing, you could be playing golf, you could be doing a lot of other things, but you have dedicated yourself to helping people that you have deep respect for, and that's the law enforcement community. How do people get hold of you?
Yeah, so the easiest way is if you will email me at mybrotherskeepertraining@gmail.com.
Try that again. Say it again.
mybrotherskeepertraining@gmail.com.
Okay. Gotcha. Look, listen, I know you have an AOL account, so I just wanted to make sure that we get everything sorted out there. Yeah, and
I'm a tech dinosaur.
I got it. So you're available to teach training courses to organizations, to police departments, and to anybody that is in this world that cares about it.
Absolutely. That's my passion. You know, I live on a farm and I raise some Christmas trees. That's my personal therapy. But there's nothing more rewarding than being able to help someone else. And I want to encourage your listeners and your viewers out there. No one is going to care for you like you're going to care for yourself. Do not wait for your department to initiate a program, for your spouse to nag you into going and getting some treatment. You take ownership and you get the help that you need, no matter what it takes, no matter how many phone calls you have to make, you are worth it.
And I wanted to say a phrase that I know you're gonna nod your head, and it's basically what you're saying, and that it's okay not to be okay. And as simple as that little adage is, every time that we as a human being deal with a situation that is abnormal, it's okay not to be okay. And there are people that care, like you, like the Wounded Blue. So, you know, we could be speaking for hours. We'll have you back on the show again. But I want to say thank you for taking the time to leave the Christmas tree farm and go find a place that actually had internet service to appear here on our show today. You know, it's been a pleasure to converse with you about a topic that you and I are both so passionate about.
Thank you for having me, Randy, and I look forward to you and I joining forces again in the near future.
That we shall. So as we wrap today's show, I want to tell you once more, if you want to help the Wounded Blue, and if you like country music, I actually have an announcement to make. This morning, I was informed that Ricky Skaggs has signed a bunch of guitars to help the Wounded Blue raise money. And he joins a whole litany of country artists who have signed guitars to help the Wounded Blue raise money to help injured and disabled officers. How do you get a guitar? Simple. Go to Guitars for Cops. That's guitars, the number 4, cops.com. You can see all of the artists. In fact, today, also Vince Gill decided he was going to sign. He actually signed 10 guitars that sold like in a heartbeat. He's signing 10 more guitars for us. So Lori Morgan is one of them. Winona Judd, Dierks Bentley, even Toby Keith, before he passed away, signed guitars for us. All these country artists care about their law enforcement officers. And you can get one of these guitars. They're only $1,000 a piece, and all that money goes to help injured and disabled officers. Go to guitarsforcops.com. This is Randy Sutton. Thank you for joining me, and we will see you again next week. Stay safe. And remember, the Wounded Blue, never forgotten, never alone.